The Necklace by Guy de Maupassant, with apologies for background noise. She was one of those pretty and charming women born as though fate had blundered into a family of junior clerks. She had no dowry, no expectations, no means of getting known, understood, loved, wedded by a man of wealth and distinction, and she let herself be married off to a minor clerk in the Ministry of Education. Her tastes were simple because she had never been able to afford otherwise, but she was as unhappy as though she had married beneath her, for women have neither caste nor class, their beauty, grace, and charm serving them for birth or family, their natural delicacy, their instinctive elegance, their nimbleness of wit are their only mark of rank, and put the working-class woman on a level with the highest lady in the land. She suffered endlessly, feeling herself born for every delicacy and luxury. She suffered from the poorness of her house, from its mean walls, worn chairs, and ugly curtains. All those things, of which other women of her class would not even have been aware, tormented and insulted her. The sight of the little Breton girl who came to do the work in her little house aroused heartbroken regrets and hopeless dreams in her mind. She imagined silent antechambers, heavy with oriental tapestries, lit by torches in lofty bronze candelabras, with two tall footmen in knee breeches asleep in large armchairs, overcome by the heavy warmth of the heating stove. She imagined vast drawing-rooms hung with antique skills, exquisite pieces of furniture supporting priceless ornaments, and small, charming, perfumed rooms, created just for little parties of intimate friends, men who were famous and sought after, whose homage roused every other woman's envious longings. When she sat down for dinner at the round table, covered with a tablecloth that had not been changed in 3 days, opposite her husband, who uncovered the stew-pot, exclaiming delightedly, "Ah, good old pot-à-feu! What could be better?" She imagined delicate meals, gleaming silver, wall-hangings with people of long ago, and strange birds in enchanted forests. She imagined delicate food served in marvellous dishes, whispered gallantries listened to with an inscrutable smile as one trifled with the pink flesh of a trout or the wings of a quail. She had no fine clothes, no jewels, nothing, and these were the only things she loved. She felt that she was made for them. She had longed so eagerly to charm, to be desired, to be wildly attractive and sought after. She had a rich friend, a former convent schoolmate, whom she would no longer visit because she suffered so keenly when she returned home. She would weep all day with grief, regret, despair, and misery. One evening her husband came home with an exultant air, holding a large envelope in his hand. "Here's something for you," he said. Swiftly she tore open the envelope and drew out a printed card on which were these words: "The Minister of Education and Madame Georges Rampenau would be honoured by the presence of Monsieur and Madame Loisel at the Ministry of Monday evening, January 8th. Instead of being delighted, as her husband had expected, she flung the invitation petulantly across the table, muttering, "What do you want me to do with this?" "Why, darling, I thought you'd be pleased. You never go out, and this is a special occasion. I went to great pains to get an invitation. Everyone wants one. It's very select, and very few are given to the clerks. You'll see all the really big people there." She eyed him furiously and said impatiently, "And what do you suppose I am to wear to such an affair?" He had not thought about it. He stammered, "Why, the gown you wear to the theatre. It looks very nice to me." He stopped, stupefied and utterly at a loss, when he saw that his wife was beginning to cry. two large tears ran slowly down from the corners of her eyes towards the corners of her mouth. "What's the matter? What's the matter?" he faltered. With a violent effort, she composed herself and replied in a calm voice, wiping her wet cheeks. "Nothing. Only I have no evening gown, and so I can't go to this ball. Give your invitation to one of your friends, whose wife will be turned out better than I shall." He was heartbroken. "Look here, Matilda," he persisted. "How much would it cost for a suitable gown, one you could use on other occasions as well, something very simple?" She thought for several seconds, figuring amounts, and also wondering how large a sum she could ask for without obtaining an immediate refusal and a horrified outcry from the frugal clerk. At last she replied with some hesitation, "I don't know exactly, but I think I could do it on 400 francs. He blanched, for this was exactly the amount he had been saving up for a gun, intending to do a little shooting the following summer on the plain of Nanterre, with some friends who went lark-shooting there on Sundays. Nevertheless, he said, "Very well, I'll give you 400 francs, but try and get a really nice gown with the money." The day of the ball drew near, and Madame Loisel seemed sad, uneasy, and anxious. Her gown was ready, however. One evening her husband said to her, "What's the matter with you? You have been very strange the last 3 days." "I am utterly miserable, because I have no jewels to wear, not a single stone," she replied. "I shall look like a nobody. I would almost rather not go to the ball." "You can wear a corsage," he said. "Flowers are in style right now. For 10 francs you can get 2 or 3 gorgeous roses." She was not convinced. "No. There's nothing so humiliating as looking poor in the company of rich women." "How stupid you are!" exclaimed her husband. "Go and see Madame Forcier, and ask her to lend you some jewels. You know her quite well enough for that." She uttered a cry of delight. "That's true, I never thought of it." Next day she went to see her friend and told her her trouble. Madame Forestier went to her mirrored wardrobe, took out a large jewelry box, brought it to Madame Loisel, opened it, and said, "Choose, my dear." First she saw some bracelets, then a pearl necklace, then a Venetian cross in gold and gems of exquisite workmanship. She tried on the jewels before the mirror, hesitating, unable to make up her mind which to take, which to leave. She kept asking, "Haven't you anything else?" "Yes, look for yourself. I don't know what you would like best." Suddenly she discovered, in a black satin case, a superb diamond necklace. Her heart began to beat with longing. Her hands trembled as she picked it up. She fastened it around her throat, over her high-necked dress, and stood there in ecstasy at sight of herself. Then, hesitating, she asked in anguish, "Could you lend me this alone?" "Yes, of course." She flung herself on her friend's neck, kissed her fervently, and took off with her treasure. The day of the ball arrived. Madame Loisel was a success. She was the prettiest woman there, elegant, graceful, smiling, and beside herself with joy. All the men stared at her, asked her name, and tried to be introduced. All the administrative officials were eager to waltz with her. The minister noticed her. She danced ecstatically, drunk with pleasure, unmindful of all else, in the triumph of her beauty, in the pride of her success, in a cloud of happiness made up of this universal homage and admiration, of the desires she had aroused, of the completeness of a victory so dear to her feminine heart. She left about 4 o'clock in the morning. Since midnight her husband had been dozing in an empty waiting room with 3 other men whose wives were having a good time. He threw over her shoulders the cloak he had brought for her to wear on the way home, a modest everyday garment whose poverty contrasted with her elegant ball gown. She was conscious of this, and was anxious to hurry away so as not to be noticed by the other women who were donning their costly furs. Loisel restrained her. "Wait a bit. You'll catch cold outside. I'll go find a cab." But she did not listen to him, and rapidly descended the staircase. When they were in the street, they could not find a cab, and began to look for one, shouting at the drivers they saw passing in the distance. They walked down towards the Seine, desperate and shivering. At last they found on the quay one of those old night-running carriages that appear in Paris only after dark, as though they were ashamed to show their shabbiness in the daylight. It brought them to their door in the Rue des Martyrs, and sadly they walked up to their apartment. It was the end for her. As for him, he was thinking that he must be at the office at 10 o'clock. She took off the cloak wrapped around her shoulders, in front of the mirror, so as to see herself once more in all her glory, but suddenly she uttered a cry. The necklace was no longer around her throat. "What's the matter with you?" asked her husband, already half undressed. She turned towards him in the utmost distress. "I've lost Madame Forestier's necklace." He stared with astonishment. "What? Impossible!" They searched in the folds of her gown, in the folds of the cloak, in the pockets, everywhere. They could not find it. "Are you sure you still had it on when you left the ball?" he asked. "Yes, I touched it in the vestibule at the ministry." "But if you had lost it in the street, we would have heard it fall. It must be in the cab." "Yes, probably. Did you take the number?" "No, you didn't notice it, did you?" "No." They stared at one another, dumbfounded. At last, Loisel put on his clothes again. "I'll go over all the ground we walked," he said, "and see if I can't find it." And he went out. She remained in her ball gown, lacking the strength to go to bed, huddled on a chair, unable to think or act. Her husband returned about 7. He had found nothing. He went to the police station, to the newspaper office to offer a reward, to the cab companies, everywhere that a ray of hope impelled him. She waited all day long, in the same state of bewilderment at this fearful catastrophe. Loisel came home at night, his face lined and pale. He had discovered nothing. "You must write to your friend," he said, "and tell her that you've broken the clasp of her necklace and are getting it mended. That will give us time to look around." She wrote at his dictation. By the end of a week, they had lost all hope. Loisel, who had aged 5 years, declared, "We must see about replacing the diamonds." Next day, they took the box that had held the necklace and went to the jeweler whose name was inside. He consulted his books. "It was not I who sold this necklace, madame. I must have merely supplied the box." Then they went from jeweler to jeweler, searching for another necklace like the first, consulting their memories, both ill with remorse and anguish. In a shop at the Palais Royal, they found a diamond necklace that seemed to them exactly like the one they were looking for. It cost 40,000 francs. They could have it for 36,000. They begged the jeweler not to sell it for 3 days, and they got him to agree to take it back for 34,000 francs if the first one was recovered before the end of February. Loisel had 18,000 francs that were left to him by his father. He intended to borrow the rest. And borrow he did. 1,000 from one man, 500 from another, 5 louis here, 3 louis there. He wrote promissory notes, entered into ruinous agreements, did business with usurers and a whole tribe of moneylenders. He mortgaged all the remaining years of his life, risked his signature without knowing if he could honor it, and, appalled at the agonizing face of the future, at the black misery about to befall him, at the prospect of every possible physical privation and moral torture, he went to get the new necklace and put down on the jeweler's counter 36,000 francs. When Madame Loisel returned the necklace, Madame Forestier said to her in a chilly voice, "You ought to have brought it back sooner. I might have needed it." She did not open the box, as her friend had feared. If she had noticed the substitution, what would she have thought? What would she have said? Would she not have taken her for a thief? Madame Loisel came to know the horrible life of abject poverty. From the very first, she played her part heroically. That dreadful debt had to be paid. She would pay it. They dismissed the maid. They moved to a garret apartment. She came to know what heavy housework meant, the hateful duties of the kitchen. She washed the dishes, wearing out her pink nails on greasy pots and pans. She washed the dirty linen, the shirts, and dish towels, and hung them out on a line to dry. Every morning she took the garbage pail down to the street and carried up water, stopping on each landing to catch her breath. And, clad like a poor woman, she went to the fruiter, to the grocer, to the butcher, a basket on her arm, haggling, insulting, fighting over every measly cent. Every month, notes had to be paid off, others renewed, time gained. Her husband worked in the evenings at putting straight a merchant's accounts, and often at night he did copying at 5 cents a page. And this life lasted for 10 years. At the end of 10 years, everything was paid off. Everything, the finance charges and the compound interest on the loans. Madame Loisel looked old now. She had become like all the other strong, hard, coarse women of poor households. Her hair was unkempt, her skirts were awry, her hands were red. She spoke in a shrill voice and slopped water all over the floor when she scrubbed it. But sometimes, when her husband was at the office, she sat down by the window and thought of that evening long ago, of the ball at which she had been so beautiful and so much admired. What would have happened if she had never lost that necklace? Who knows, who knows? How strange life is, how fickle, how little it takes to ruin you or to save you. One Sunday, as she was taking a walk along the Champs-Élysées to relax from the toils of the week, she caught sight suddenly of a woman who was walking with a child. It was Madame Forestier, still young, still beautiful, still attractive. Madame Loisel felt moved. Should she speak to her? Yes, certainly. And now that she had paid, she would tell her all. Why not? She went up to her. "Good morning, Jean." The other woman did not recognize her, and was surprised at being so familiarly addressed by the poor woman. "But, madame," she stammered, "I don't know. You must be making a mistake." "No, I am Mathilde Loisel." Her friend uttered a cry. "Oh, my poor Mathilde, how you have changed." "Yes, I have had some hard times since I saw you last, and many sorrows, and all because of you."
"Because of me? How was that?"
"You remember the diamond necklace you lent me for the ball at the ministry?"
"Yes,
well?"
"Well, I lost it."
"How so? Why, you brought it back."
"I brought you another one just like it, and for the last 10 years we have been paying for it. You realize it wasn't easy for us. We had no money. Well, it's paid for at last, and I am glad indeed."
Madame Forestier had halted.
"You say you bought a diamond necklace to replace mine?"
"Yes."
"You didn't notice it? They were very much alike." And she smiled with a proud and innocent joy. Madame Forestier, deeply moved, took her two hands.
"Oh, my poor Mathilde! But mine was an imitation. It was worth
at the very most 500 francs.